BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Nick, do you remember those days of yore when Labour leaders got elected and they'd come to power and the tune that was blaring in the background, which Rishi Sunak heard when he was on the steps of Downing Street in the rain not so long ago, was "Things Can Only Get Better"? Whereas these days, it's like a different tune when Labour come into power, isn't it?
Yeah, things can only get worse, Keir Starmer seems to be telling us. Or at least things can only get worse before maybe one day they get better, but maybe not in the first 5 years, if you elect us again in the second term, by the 10th year of a Keir Starmer administration. It's not all that uplifting, is it?
No, nor is this talk of black holes. When I saw that Keir Starmer was giving a speech about black holes, I was thinking he's turned into an astrophysicist.
Brian Cox, leading the Labour Party.
Exactly, where there is that D-Ream connection. But no, he's talking about black holes much closer to home.
He is, because one we're familiar with, aren't we? In every election, all the political parties, and indeed we, when we're asking the question, talk about budgetary black holes, a black hole in the public finances. How are they going to fill it? Well, he's now claiming that there's a £22 billion black hole that he had no idea that was there. But he added a new black hole, not a phrase I think they will be stitching into the banners for marches in the future, what he called a societal black hole as a result of the years of Tory rule. What does he mean by that? We're going to try and work out with a woman who was his policy chief, who probably knows the answer.
So this is not a podcast about cosmology. This is a podcast about the politics of Britain this week and into the future. What are Keir Starmer's black holes? And more importantly, what might fill them? Let's do it. Hello, it's Amol back in the Today Podcast studio alongside my friend.
And it's good to be back here after what was quite a long summer for me. Lovely.
Yeah, but the thing is, Nick, people don't realise that we've been away. Because what we did is I mean, this is terrible. We shouldn't be admitting to these tricks of the trade, but we pre-recorded a couple of podcasts.
Just one or two.
So amazingly, we've not actually been alongside each other for at least 3 or 4 weeks. How's your summer been?
I have had a lovely, restful, British seaside summer. Where, yes, I swam with seals again. Remember we talked about that? Yeah. Seals pouncing. Well, they still haven't pounced. But after we talked about that on the podcast a few weeks back, I was a little bit more cautious. Because as I was teasing you at the idea that seals were in some sense a danger, classically someone who was listening to this podcast wrote in and said they are. If you get bitten by a seal, you're in real trouble.
Isn't that so, when we heard from a seilographer? Am I making that up? Oh, it's in the midst of time.
Well, it's all a long time ago.
Well, as is for you, well, not that long ago, having young children. I've just been away for a few weeks with young children. And you know that thing when you come back from a holiday and you realise that's when you need the holiday?
That's
me.
Now you need it. Now, what I find really interesting about this week we're recording in is it reminds me of when I was political editor for all those years, because you know that politicians always get twitchy in bank holiday weekend. I would often kid myself when I was a political reporter that I could take bank holiday Monday off, I could relax. Every time I did it, something dramatic happened in politics. I remember standing on a cliffside in Devon, taking a phone call about the fact that Tony Blair had just declared he was not going to stand down as Labour Party leader and Prime Minister, and therefore that Gordon Brown was not going to take over from him.
What's that, 2006?
Back in 2006, things happen. And of course, what happened this week was that Keir Starmer gave the speech he'd obviously been planning to give weeks ago, but the riots got in the way. The speech that said, it's all the Tories' fault and it's all pretty miserable.
All of which could have been predicted. I mean, it was about as classic a rolling of the pitch as you get in politics, wasn't it? It was a way of coming into power and saying, we've had a look at the books. I mean, this is one of the things that in the election campaign, on the Today programme, in your interviews with the people who wanted to be prime minister and the leaders of different parties, is something that we warned again and again and again to our listeners might well happen. And I do think there are amazingly interesting echoes of history here, because in 2010, when the coalition government came into power, they had been warning for some time their version of the black holes we're going to talk about, as they said, we've got a broken economy, we've got a broken society. I remember hearing that an awful lot. And we've got broken politics. That was after the expenses scandal. And I'm sure if we go further back in time, you'll have other examples examples of people that have said their first budget is going to talk about how dreadful their economic inheritance is. But I also think there's something else going on here, which is that isn't this a little bit of Keir Starmer, not just preparing people for things they might not like, but trying to earn a mandate? We talked in a podcast just before our summer break and after the election about how, despite having a big majority as a result of that general election, he didn't necessarily have a big mandate. And that was because, actually, the number of people that voted for Labour was lower than some people had predicted, and we've had this splintering of politics. So don't you think there's an element here of Keir Starmer trying to earn the right, earn a mandate to do some difficult things, and as he would put it, stick around for a long time?
A mandate for what, though, I think exactly. Is the question. Because as well as talking about the budgetary black hole and what he calls the societal black hole, I want to talk to our guest, Claire Ainslie, who used to be policy chief for Keir Starmer, about another black hole, which is, I think, it's not too opinionated for me to say, a black hole in the vision. What's it all for? Now, that may well be about to come. It may come in his party conference speech, which obviously will be a huge moment for him, the first as Prime Minister, the first as a Labour Prime Minister at a Labour conference for many, many years. It may come in the budget that he's now really bigged up, hasn't he, and told us that will be painful. Some people look at this speech this week, though, say, how long can you blame the other lot? How long can you blame the previous government? Do you know my answer to that? As long as you like. You just keep on doing it. Successful politicians write a narrative. They write a narrative about the failures of their predecessors, and they say it forever. And if they get it right, it sticks in the public mind forever. The winter of discontent, 1979. The Tories talked about Labour presiding over a government in which the dead lay unburied in the street and rubbish was in piles on the streets.
Very powerful image. I remember. That was Geoffrey Howe.
A great deal of time. Geoffrey Howe and Margaret Thatcher. Geoffrey Howe, her first chancellor. Gordon Brown talked about boom and bust until, frankly, there was a bust and he couldn't do it anymore in 2008. The Tories, as you say, under Osborne and Cameron, kept saying there's no money left, talking about repairing the roof when the sun is shining. So you can do this for pretty much as long as you like. It doesn't mean that people don't blame you for problems, but it does give some explanation of why everything isn't perfect the second you get into office.
There is a battle for the narrative, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, just to apply a bit of scrutiny to what you're saying the Labour Party are saying, you could cherry pick some economic data to say, actually, you know what, their economic inheritance isn't that bad. Shop prices are down. There's a bit of decent news around in terms of growth. Interest rates are on the downward trajectory. You could say that, a bit like, you know, John Major and Ken Clark's inheritance, or if you like what they passed on to the new Labour government, actually, in some ways, the economy is about to turn a corner, which is the argument that Rishi Sunak was meant to make during the election. Of course, you could look at lots.
He could be making now if he'd not had an early election.
It's looking a weirder and weirder decision. It'd be interesting to ask Rishi Sunak whether or not, you know, in a year from now, whether or not he could be honest and say he felt he'd made a mistake. But anyway, the point is it reasonable for Labour to say, oh, things are much worse than they were? The Tories would say, A, if you cherry pick the right data, actually things are getting better, not worse. And Paul Johnson of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, who we often have on the Today programme, we've had on this podcast recently, kept on saying to us before the election, you know what, we know the numbers, we know they're bad.
They're able to point to one or two details, which they can say the so-called Treasury Reserve has been spent and we didn't know it's going to be spent. The Tories didn't make provision for higher public sector pay, despite the fact they asked the independent pay review bodies to look at it. And therefore, they must have known that if they'd got re-elected, they would have had to pay.
And asylum and immigration.
And so on and so forth. But the big picture, not the detail, not a billion here or a billion there, was there a problem in the public finances? Not only was known, it was talked about and they were asked about it and they made a decision not to seek the mandate you talked about beyond that one word, change. And the great joy of change is it could mean whatever you wanted it to mean. Nobody knew what it meant. Keir Starmer never defined it. But he added a thing this week, and that's what I found so interesting about this speech. He even went as far as to suggest that the rioters over the summer knew that there was this societal black hole and were exploiting it. They knew that the criminal justice system was in crisis, and they rioted because they thought they might get away with their crimes. Let's have a listen to what he said.
They saw the cracks in our society after 14 years of failure, and they exploited them. That's what we've inherited. Not just an economic black hole, a societal black hole. And that's why we have to take action and do things differently. And part of that is being honest with people about the choices that we face, how tough this will be. And frankly, things will get worse before they get better.
I said you couldn't stitch it into a banner. Can you imagine trying to chant it? What do we want? To fill the societal black hole. When do we want it? Towards the end of a second Labour term. It's not going to work, is it?
Do you think that the fact that the riots came so soon after the general election is going to define this parliamentary term? Do you think they looked at those riots and thought, you know what, if we don't get our act together, we could be facing sort of serious social breakdown? Because there is something strange about that reference to a societal black hole, which is you didn't really hear much talk about it before the election. It wasn't really central to Keir Starmer's pitch, this idea of him as chief prosecutor we're very familiar with. He's Mr. Law and Order. He knows about prisons. He knows about crime and all the rest of it, the courts and working through the backlogs. And, of course, he was chief prosecutor when there were riots in 2011. But it's just something, quite, as you say, it's something sort of quite surprising about the emergence of this kind of focus on societal issues. And because there's something surprising about it, my question would be, not only what is all this pain that he's talking about for, which we'll get to in a second, but where's the policy agenda that goes with fixing that social black hole? So I would say, where's Streeting on health? Matthew Pennycook on planning. You could say Rachel Reeves on the economy. Parts of what Ed Miliband's doing with energy. There's a lot of policy activity. On social reform, is it basically the case that Labour's answers are economic problems to social solutions, which is what the left is often accused of?
Well, in the speech he gave, Starmer accused the Tories of using populism instead of policy to deal with it. So essentially, when you detect anger in what became known as the left behind communities after Brexit, the communities that had been ignored, if you like, by central government, his claim was what the Tories did was throw rhetorical red meat. We'll stop the boats. We'll cut immigration. We'll get Brexit done. We'll have a war with Brussels. We'll leave the European Convention on Human Rights, or hint that we might leave it. He seems to be saying, actually, what people want is decent, well-paid jobs. They want security. They want decent education. They want to be able to live a life in the communities they were born in, rather than having to leave them in order to make a better life. So he no doubt could say lots of the core Labour agenda to do with pay, to do with workers' rights, to do with improving state schooling, etc., will deliver something. But I think you're right to say that even before the riots, given the very high vote for reform and the high profile for Nigel Farage, that there was a perception that what has happened in large parts of Western Europe that we've talked about on this programme, whether it's the rise of the FD in Germany or of the non-conventional right in Italy or Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, he must know, Starmer, the people around him do know that there is a risk that if he doesn't deliver on that conventional Labour agenda, making your life better if you're working class, they'll listen to other people on the
And
fight.
The risk that that should transpire is bigger in an era where you've got no money. I think, Nick, one of the things we should do on this podcast, apart from lifting the lid, having more time to get into depth, is we should confront and really take on things that people are too scared to take on. And I'd put to you that one of the things people are too scared to take on is the fact that there are parts of this country where economic forces are going against them, where jobs are leaving, where the economic sort of gravity is clustering around these superstar cities, and there are parts, particularly of coastal Britain, that are left behind because the economy and modern technology is leaving them behind. And it's what you do about those areas, which, you know, Keir Starmer's referring to as a societal black hole, that, you know, is a big challenge for Labour. And I'm not sure that economic solutions are necessarily going to work.
You're absolutely right. And what's weird about it is that we're having a conversation about it at all as if it's surprising. Why did Britain vote leave? Mm. I mean, this is an argument that goes back to 2016. And of course, it goes back much further than that, because lots of the areas that did vote leave, which then have this label left behind, were areas that had seen economic destruction. I think that's the right word, under Margaret Thatcher's government. So the decline of coal and of steel and of shipbuilding, traditional industries, left those communities with very little hope. And governments came and went. And critically, a powerful Labour government came and went, without things getting much better. And there is an argument, therefore, that whether it was voting leave, whether it was voting for Boris Johnson in 2019 in large numbers, the so-called Red Wall no longer exists, whether it was voting for Farage in his various guises, whether UKIP or the Brexit Party or the Reform Party, was all part of that long, long story of people saying, look, we knew where we were when our kids could be miners or steelworkers or shipbuilders or work in the local factory. And ever since then, these communities have had very little.
It's so interesting you say that. You just wonder whether or not Labour come in, look at the riots, they say we've got a big societal black hole. But they end up doing what a lot of governments end up doing, which is thinking the only levers they can pull are economic levers. And the only point I would make about that is, if you, as we've been discussing, if you look at the public finances in this country, there aren't a huge number of economic levers you can pull and to unleash billions of pounds of investment. It's not like 1997. This is an era of tight money, big debt, and you just wonder whether or not Labour are going to have the money to sort some of these problems out that they've identified. Well, we love hearing from you, as we always say. Your voice notes, your emails, please do say hello, tell us what you think, and join the pod squad.
And remember the WhatsApp, save it into your phone. It's +44 330 123 4346, or email us today at bbc.co.uk. So we've mentioned her already, our guest this week, Claire Ainslie, who was Director of Policy for Keir Starmer until 2022. Her ideas captured in a book. She wrote something called The New Working Class, which I know you've read, Amal. And she is now Claire Ainslie, Director of the Washington, D.C.-based Progressive Policy Institute, a think tank dedicated, it says, to centre-left renewal. Claire, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Claire, I feel like I've got a dreadful advantage over Nick in having read this book, which is not usually the case that I've read a book and he hasn't on this podcast, usually the other way around. Your book was hugely influential, and I don't need, that's not just me saying that, it was really off the back of that book and the impact it had on leftish and centre-left thinking in this country that you got the job with Keir Starmer. Can I just take away or mention three of the takeaways I took from that book, things that are percolating through my mind? Basically, I think one of the things you were trying to do with that book, tell me if I've got this wrong, is you were trying to make all of us understand, and particularly those on the people on the centre-left of politics understand, that the working class that we refer to today is very different to the working class that Marx and Engels were talking about 170-odd years ago. And it's very different in really important ways. First of all, the working class that Marx and Engels were talking about often worked with physical labour, physical demands, literally selling their physical labour for a wage. Often you get people in menial jobs today that aren't doing that. The second thing is there was a very strong class consciousness then. A lot of the time people were part of trade unions or working men's clubs, which have seen some decline. And then the third thing is that you talked about the massive variety amongst the modern British poor. And this will get us into what Keir Starmer was talking about today. The fact that some people who are working class work, but there are plenty who don't. And actually, it's that sustained multi-generational worklessness, the fact that you've got people who are poor but not working, that's the key to understanding the societal black holes that Keir Starmer was talking about.
Absolutely right. When you think about what it means to be working class today in modern Britain, it does include the traditional working class, but that's quite a small part of the population these days. So the image is not necessarily of a traditional, probably working class. You might think of an ethnically white man, probably in his 60s. When you think of someone who's working class today, actually it's far more likely to be a woman who might be cleaning a building, might be running two jobs. And as you say, it's much, much more diverse. And really, if you bring that diverse group of people together, you have a very sizable part of the British electorate that, frankly, at that time, 2018, nobody was trying to speak for. And subsequently, of course, we talked a lot more about the Red Wall, that phrase of those places that were geographically specific. But my argument was much more that if you were to find our working class voters today, they are in your offices. They're just not necessarily the people that are doing the office jobs. They are in every town, high street in this country. And actually, if you understand their economic and their social interests and their cultural values, you may be on course to have a parliamentary majority. And of course, that's what Starmer then attempted to do at the last election.
So what was he attempting to do this week when he used that rather baffling phrase, societal black hole? And what did you make specifically of him trying to link that with the riots, to say that the riots were in some way linked with the failure of Tory policy to deliver, we assume, to that group?
I thought when Starmer talked about this societal black hole, I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of this speech. And I don't think it's been fully articulated yet, but I think he was getting at something that many people have seen, felt, referred to. And it talks to this sense that our societal bonds are less strong, and it not be a nostalgic look back at somehow what community used to mean, but it'd be a much more forward-looking modern articulation of what Britain could be. And I think that that existed well before the riots. I think it's actually part of why people voted to leave the European Union in the first place. It's also the hope is what we saw during the pandemic, where we started to see the role of society and community really come to the fore. We all turned to our friends, our neighbours, our family, much more than we did the state. And nobody's really quite articulated that into a political vision as yet. But I thought Starmer was starting to lay some of the bones of that down in this speech this week.
So spell it out, though, the link with the riots, because there'll be plenty of people listening who say, hold on, the riots were about one very simple thing, criminality. There'll be other people who say, well, maybe there was a second thing, which is the influence among some, by no means all, of the far right, if not sort of fascist forces. But you're saying underlying all that is something much bigger about the nature of our society.
I think Starmer's been really clear, and I agree, that the people who rioted, who were violent, were absolutely not speaking for the ordinary Britons that they somehow, you know, sometimes claim to represent. They were thugs on the whole. They are not representative of ordinary Brits today. I think what Starmer was getting at was a much deeper sense of discontent and frustration that lots of people have felt, and I think you see it represented in people not voting at all, that somehow the strong society that we have had in the past is not standing up to the strains of modern Britain. And by that, I mean that people are feeling they are disrespected in their communities. They're feeling that crimes are going unpunished, and they are feeling like they are not getting the kind of economic opportunities that they would want to see in their community. And they're getting a raw deal. And I think a lot of people feel like they're doing the right thing, going out to work, telling their kids it's their hard work that will propel them on. And that is not what they're finding. They can't then afford a decent standard of living. And I think that discontent is what was bubbling under the Brexit referendum. I think Johnson talked to it when he talked about levelling up, but I don't think anyone has yet delivered on it. And I think Starmer is finding his way of describing that. And of course, then the challenge is, how do you then have a political programme that actually brings the country together and actually delivers real benefits for people? Because that's what people want to see and what Labour will be judged on.
There'll be a huge number of people, Claire, that listen to you and say, well, there's one thing that connects every single thing you've spoken about. You say we don't have a strong society, the bonds of society have been frayed, we've got a low trust society. You say that people have been denied their dignity, and you refer to the fact they feel a sense of cultural and economic loss. And there's a lot of people listening to this podcast, a lot of people who vote in British elections, who say it's very simple. It's mass migration. We've had an era of 20 years of globalisation, which has created huge losers. And globalisation has worked in the poor world for the rich and the poor. It's worked in the rich world for the rich. But there are millions of people around the world turning now to populists because they believe they've been ignored by the elite that don't listen to them, but that genuinely globalisation and mass migration has robbed them of their agency, robbed them of their dignity, and has fractured the bonds of society that you refer to there. Is that analysis correct?
I think that migration is part of the issues that we have to confront. And it's not just illegal migration. It is also legal migration, and it is integration and how our society is structured and organised. I do not believe, however, that immigration is the sole or even necessarily the root cause. I just don't think you can sidestep and avoid it. I think we need to confront the fact that we have not currently got controlled and managed borders, and we have not had that for some time, and that that is part of what people voted for previously, and they will keep speaking to that until there is a government who can come up with some of the solutions, practical, real solutions, not, you know, digressions like failed Rwanda scheme and so on. So I think migration cannot be denied. It is part of the problem. It matters for migrants as well as the communities where migrants are. But I also think that that isn't necessarily the root cause. I think the root cause is this failure of economic opportunity, i.e. people just don't have the kind of rising living standards that start to see everybody progress upwards. And that is the root cause of the problem.
Does Keir Starmer have the economic answers here? Would he, if he was having a candid conversation, say, well, look, I'm just representing the ideas I already had, which is greater rights for working people, more stable and predictable lives, better pay and so on, improved public services, state schools, the NHS. Does that do it? Or are you saying if there is a societal black hole, there is still at the moment a bit of a black hole in the policy thinking about how you fill it?
So I think there are two things. I think there is the first is the kind of, the, as you say, what's the economic programme? And I think it has to be a really ambitious economic programme to, you know, reset how our economy works. And I think that Starmer has put much of that into his programme. I do think that better employment rights for people are at the core of it. But I also think more economic opportunities across the country. So not just redistribution from south to north, crudely, but everybody feeling like within their vicinity, they have the chance to progress. And that means putting infrastructure investment in. It's things like the National Wealth Fund that have been announced by Labour. So really driving economic growth and having that idea of remaking the deal for working people at the core so that it's your hard work and talent that propels you on. So I think economics is absolutely fundamental. But the second aspect to it, and I would like to see more on this, is how we go about actively remaking those societal bonds. And I think that that cannot just happen organically. I think that this pandemic showed that people want to come together as communities, but there's been very little state support to do that. If anything, the state has kind of walked away over the past 10 years of austerity from some of those community arrangements that I think people thrived on.
Can you give an example? So what like sort of thing?
Well, I would like to see there being much more investment in community organisations, mutual and peer support for people. That spirit that we had during the pandemic, do you remember when people were volunteering for the NHS? Why can't we make that into a national programme to tackle some of the loneliness for our older people? And I actually think, although the Conservatives were really, you know, this policy was rubbish during the election about national service for young people because it was a bit sort of clumsily introduced, I think there is something about how we get our young people investing in their communities. And I think there's a opportunity there, if not national service, to have some kind of community service where people are much more community orientated.
I want to address with the freedom this podcast gives us. I want to address what's a bit of a taboo subject, but I think we should address, which is something that Matthew Paris got into trouble with talking about Clacton over a decade ago. Matthew Paris of The Times and Radio 4 wrote a now notorious column where he talked about Clacton, and he was quite denigrating of Clacton. He talked about it as an all our yesterday's type place. And UKIP made great hay with this, of course, with Douglas Carswell. Isn't it just the truth, Claire, that there are some parts of this country, deindustrialised places, often parts of coastal Britain, amazing places, beautiful places, full of extraordinary talent, but the currents, the gusts, the winds of modern economics and technology are just causing these places to be not hollowed out, but to be neglected, that there is this trend towards big, powerful cities, clusters of people, often university towns. And there are lots and lots of places in this country that a century ago or half a century ago had thriving local economies that just don't anymore. Nick and I have presented the Today programme from some of these places. And I'm not saying they're hopeless. I'm not trying to repeat the errors that Matthew Paris would perhaps say he'd made with Clacton and that column a decade ago. But I just want us to be honest and frank about the fact that there are large pockets of this country where the economic headwinds are against them.
So change is inevitable, right? Like, if you go to those places and you talk to people, change is inevitable. But why do people in those places always have to be the people who have to suck up the bad bits of the change and never get to drive some of the bits that are important to them? And for lots of people, they don't want to move from their place and they're not expecting to have some high value tech job right on their doorstep. But they do want to have a sense of pride in their place, choice over whether they move for one of those high value jobs, quite honestly, or have a long commute, or whether they can make a living, just make a living. They're not asking to be necessarily rich, but make a living in the place they are. And if you think imaginatively about some of those places, it's not about saying that we need some big distribution warehouse, God forbid, to descend on all of those places. But the amount of health and social care needs there are in the future, it's a huge growth sector. Why can't we have a workforce plan that enables us to drive up the quality of social care, wages in social care, so that people in those places can, as I say, just earn a living? I don't think people want much, but they want to not be forgotten.
Do you believe, as a former director of policy for Keir Starmer, that he has the plans for this? Because some people on the left watching this speech this week fear that when he talks about painful choices in the budget, when he talks about difficult decisions, not just on tax, but on spending and welfare too, he's actually talking about a return to George Osborne's economics.
I think what Starmer's got that I think a lot of those left critics misunderstand is that I think he's got a sense of what people in the places we're talking about actually want for themselves and their lives. They don't want a massive handout. They don't necessarily want massive redistribution, even though, let's face it, we would all like there to be more headroom for some infrastructure investment. What they want is the opportunity to do all right for themselves and their families and to be treated with respect. And I think he has got his eye on that prize, and that is what he wants to do.
But is cutting winter fuel payments part of that vision? And if he has to make other cuts like that, can that be part of that vision, or does it contradict him?
Well, I'm sure that he wishes that they weren't having to do that. Like, these aren't choices that they're relishing. And I don't think he should do a sort of David Cameron and somehow dress this up as some grand kind of political narrative. It's sort of a we are where we are type narrative. What I think he does have to do, though, is give us more of a sense of where it is we're going to, because people will understand difficult political choices, but they won't understand if it's just experienced as loss and loss only. So if it's continuing to just chip away at the sort of gains that we feel we've made, whether it's winter fuel allowance or other types of, you know, the universal benefits that we seem to have taken as read, that will be experienced, I think, far differently if we were to have a clearer sense of where we're going. So I think part of what the next chapter in this story that he's telling us is where is it we're heading to? What is the pain in aid of? Give us that vision and that direction. And I think part of what he talked about in that speech was getting there, but I think we need to see far more of that so that people can understand why those choices are being made, but where it is it will get us to as a country.
Do you worry that that's another black hole alongside the budget black hole he speaks of and the societal black hole? So far, at least, there's a bit of a vision black hole, a positive vision black hole.
I think he's got it. I just think that I think we heard it during the election campaign. It's just that, you know, if you're taking a country through significant change, which is what he got a mandate to do, it's what that manifesto said. It was all about change. People don't want to experience change in every aspect of their life. They want to know that the change the country is going on, that they are themselves having to play a part in, is taking them to a destination that is going to mean that they are better off, or that their next generation are better off. So I just would like to see more of that vision dialed up in all of the speeches, even the ones that are kind of levelling with us about the state of the public finances. Otherwise, I think it's quite hard to keep people with you on this difficult journey.
Claire, most of us haven't worked in politics. When you got the call, take us inside that call, inside the room. When you got the call from, was it Keir Starmer that called you and said, Claire, I've read your book, fascinating stuff, everyone says you're fantastic. What was his pitch to you, presumably, if you thought he was going to be Prime Minister? It's quite an exciting phone call to get. What did he say he wanted you to do for him?
Well, it was an exciting phone call, but let's be honest, this would have been in whatever it was, March 2020, when we were 26 points behind the Tories. So it was, we always talked about, like, what would you do in power? But a lot of it was about how do we get the Labour Party back on the path to be representing working class people again? And I felt really seized by that mission, to be honest. I thought he got it completely. And that's what the group of us went in to do, was to set Labour on that path.
And have you got, give us a sense of one or two of the kind of really bold policies that you were trying to say to him, look here, this is your ground. If you do this, you can seize the initiative, you can win back the working class vote, and you can transform the lives of those people in the places that we've been talking about. What were some of the policy suggestions you really wanted him to go for it on?
I wanted us to have a very clear plan on economic growth across the country, because I thought that devolution and regional economic growth was where the improved living standards would come from. I would like to see, and I want to see, a big house building programme, because I think getting the next generation on the housing ladder, our opportunity to own, I think is really important. And at the time, I proposed points-based immigration system, which, as you'll know, in 2018 was not exactly popular on the centre-left. Those were the sorts of things. You've got to give people an economic security platform. You've got to give them the opportunity to get on, and you've got to reassure them that you are going to control the borders, because those are the key things, I think, that shows you're representing those people once again.
There may be people listening who think, is the fact that Claire Ainslie isn't still at Keir Starmer's side, isn't working South Downing Street, suggests he doesn't actually agree with you on that?
I mean, I wouldn't read anything into it. Look, personally, I live in the north of England, not in one of those places you're talking about, a lovely part of the north of England, I'm sure. But it wasn't something that was going to be compatible with two young children to do in government. So there was certainly no kind of policy or political dust up, I'm afraid. It was just me saying, look, I've done this for 2.5 years. I need to spend some more time sorting my family out and time with them. So, yeah, so there's no political disagreement on that. And I'm fully supportive of what he and the team are doing.
And a final question. Amol raised the possibility earlier that these riots, that the big forces you're talking about that were operating long before the riots, could define this government, more likely for ill rather than for good. That, in other words, the very group you identify, what you call the new working class, could, to put it crudely, do for Labour in the next few years if they don't get this right. Do you agree?
I don't agree that the riots will, because I maintain that the people, the small number of people that were rioting, do not represent the much bigger sentiment that there is in the country about people feeling disrespected. But I do think that if Labour don't listen to the legitimate concerns people have about economic opportunity, about controlling immigration, and about doing better for the next generation, then yes, that will be kind of mission critical for them.
Claire, it's really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time when you have got a hell of a lot on. And good luck in your newest job in Washington as well.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Good to talk.
Okay, what do you make of that? Influential person.
Yeah, and fascinating thoughts, aren't they? And I think Keir Starmer thinks he is addressing a lot of that. He talks again and again in the election, you and I noted it, about the working class, a phrase that for a very long time Labour leaders did not use. He talked about his dad. You know, people joked that he constantly reminded us he was a toolmaker, but he talked about his dad's values, not just economic values, but values about society. So I think Claire Ainslie is where Keir Starmer wants to be. The question is whether he will be in that place. And I maintain that the time we'll really know that is in that budget. Does the budget just look like an extension of the austerity years? Oh dear, we haven't quite got enough money and we'll spend some money on filling these alleged black holes. Or does it feel like the beginning of some greater vision?
And if the budget, which is, you know, your moment with a big theatre, as you've often talked about, your chance to pull lots of levers and try and see the effects in the country, if the budget reveals that actually, as Rachel Reeves has been telling us, there isn't that much money, where'd you go? That's the interesting thing. If you're talking about societal black holes and you've got a disposition in politics, which is that most of the solutions to those societal black holes are economic solutions, i.e. money, if you haven't got much money, you could be in trouble. And then the other thing that I just think she was sort of saying without saying explicitly there, which was interesting, was about immigration. She did, in her answer to me on migration, she did acknowledge up front the huge pressures it had created, the loss of agency that some people felt. She said it's not to blame for everything. But I have to say, I didn't realise, despite reading the brilliant briefing notes from our team, I didn't realise that she'd advocated in 2018 a points-based system. It does suggest to me that there's a sort of consensus within the Labour family that there wasn't 15 years ago or 10 years ago, that immigration is putting pressure on the new working class, as she calls it.
The big thought this week, I think, is that contrast, isn't it, in the week when we're talking about Oasis getting back on the road, the band getting back together, with the upbeat tone of Tony Blair when he had his huge majority and the downbeat tone of Keir Starmer. The team got out the words of Tony Blair's conference speech back in 1997 when he talked about wanting to be nothing less than the model 21st century nation, a beacon to the world. We can never be the biggest, he said. We may never again be the mightiest, but we can be the best place to live, the best place to bring up children, the best place to lead a fulfilled life, the best place to grow old. Can you hear Keir Starmer saying that in this conference speech? I mean, he may agree with that aspiration, that hope, that ambition, but it doesn't fit with the tone of what he's said this week.
The hopey, changey stuff has long been the big vacancy in British politics, and after this week, it still feels that, doesn't it?
Certainly does. Well, it is that time for our moment of the week. But before we come to ours, let us welcome our guest today, Tom Walker. Hello.
Hello. That's really interesting. That is the first introduction I've ever had for an interview that I wasn't introduced as Tom Walker, a.k.a. Jonathan Pye.
Well, because I wanted you to do it.
Which is the full title.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. No, that's exactly. I wanted people to go, Tom.
Who the hell is that?
They're at home going, Tom Walker.
Or they go, is it the singer?
Whereas if I'd said Jonathan Pye, they would have gone, oh, yeah.
Oh, him.
But you are him.
I am.
But you are sort of you first.
I'm more me than him.
Are you? That's for the very, very, very few people that don't know Jonathan Pye, either through your enormous social media following or indeed what you do on Radio 4, Tom, who is Jonathan Pye?
Jonathan Pye is a senior deputy Westminster correspondent, which whatever that means. He's senior deputy Westminster correspondent for the BBC, and he's stuck on College Green day in, day out. And he's the news reporter that between takes tells you what he really thinks.
For the time being, at least, a UK military intervention seems unlikely. Why are we doing this outside? Well, because it's cold and it's starting to rain and we can easily do it from a studio. I'm just wondering what... Yeah, well, that's very easy for you to say in your ivory tower. I'm just wondering... Really? Really? Okay, do you hear what you just said?
What was it about the career of my friend Nick Robinson that inspired you to think there was enormous comic potential in the life of a political reporter?
I've often thought that when, you know, you're doing a report and you're trying to be all nice and balanced because you're at the BBC and you're trying to... You must occasionally, or particularly if you're in the studio, they must be reading the auto cue and in their head going, that's nonsense. That's just totally not right. But you can't do it, you know. I don't know if we're allowed to mention, you know, your ex-American correspondent, but I would quite often watch Sopel talking about Trump and thinking he wants to lose it. He's just come out of a press conference and he wants to really go for it, but he's holding back.
Funnily enough, I don't think I have ever really sounded off between takes, other than once when a protester came up behind my head.
Yes.
And this was the first austerity budget. I was a bit hyped up to get this coverage right. And I wasn't irritated with his message, which was stop war, not the poor, or something like that. I was just irritated. This blooming banner was coming up my head. And as soon as I was off air, after the late, great George Alagaya had very kindly said, well done for keeping calm, because all the viewers could think about this blooming great banner coming up my head, I'm afraid I did grab it and snap it in half.
I mean, I've stood on College Green, I've seen actual reporters actually doing the job, and I don't know how they do it. But particularly post-Brexit, in those couple of years between when we voted for it and when we got it, and you'd go live on air, and that's why you had to start wearing these kind of mics like that. How you keep your cool when people are screaming and shouting at you.
But you were inspired by a particular moment.
Yes, the late, great Peter Sissons. There's a clip on YouTube where he is, clearly they've gone to the sport or the weather or something, and he's slumped across the desk like this, which in itself is pretty amusing, just watching someone like this, you know. And you can hear The Weakest Link is on.
Let's listen to it.
That's not Anne Robinson, is it? Jesus Christ.
Finally, with the children safely in bed.
She's even got new tits.
Oh,
And I think that is the birth of pie, that moment there.
You just thought, that is it, the off-camera moment.
There always used to be, it's kind of ubiquitous now to have kind of outtakes and clips, but it used to be It'll Be All Right on the Night, which was like once a year. And I think it was one of my, as a kid, it was one of my favourite programmes. Loved it.
And there were lots of spin-offs of it, wasn't there? There was a programme called It's Behind You,
right,
which was purely about what happened behind the person on camera.
Right, yes.
And I got called at one stage, because they have to get your permission to use this stuff, saying, can we do the moment you tried on the fur hat? And I had never known about it. I had no clue what they were talking about. And it turned out that somebody in the office had got a fur hat. And in the way, when news was a little bit boring,
yes,
I was parading round the fur hat. I mean, proper kind of look at this. Here's me in a fur hat. And not like once behind the guy doing the two-way, as we call it, doing the interview on the news channel about not very much, just filling time. But back, forward, looking at the hat, pointing the hat.
You've forgotten you've done it.
I've never thought about this, but you listening to you, Tom, it makes you realise why news is so perfect for comedy, because it's the seriousness of news, the kind of importance and the gravitas of news, almost the pomposity of it, some might say, that allows you that scope for comedy to be all the other bits, the hidden bits that you don't see. I mean, I remember growing up with Brass Eye, Chris Morris, who I think is one of the great geniuses of post-war British culture. And for some reason, it was just so funny when he said, I think he went to Brussels to speak to our correspondent, Han Rahan. I don't know why that's funny, but it's comedy's a deviation from the seriousness of news, isn't it?
I think that's why Pi works, and I think that's why Pi works even if he's not your political bent, is because we all have the at-work persona and the at-home persona, the talking to your boss on the phone persona and the talking to your mum on the phone persona, and that we can switch between them quite quickly. And I think that's why the comedic idea of Pi is kind of universal, that he can switch from this very sort of prescribed way of talking, this very BBC way of talking, and this rather sort of neither here nor there kind of way of talking, to suddenly switch to effing and jeffing and swearing.
You should see Nick Robinson when we come off the Today programme.
No, I'm programmed to be the same at all times. Now, talking of your mum, is that lady through the glass?
That's my mum.
You are the first guest to bring their mum.
Hi, Pippa.
Hello.
She's going to hate you.
Pippa, do you want to come in and be on the microphone? Is that what you're...
No.
We're supposed to do a moment of the week.
We are.
This is my moment of the week. My mum's here. I haven't seen my mum for a few years. She lives in Australia.
Oh,
and
wow.
And she is visiting. And it would seem silly to go, Mum, I'm just going to the BBC, you stay at home. So I thought, come and see what the BBC's like.
It's weird, because your mum is within eyeshot on the other side of the glass where the pod squad are gathered. And I feel strange talking about your mum, though she can hear us. But why did your mum move to Australia?
My sister moved to Australia about 12 years ago. And then my mum had been living in Italy for a decade or so and wanted to move away. And it was either move to London with me or sunny Australia with my sister.
So the short summary I would have done in my news two-way was, she shows your sister.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the off-camera moment, we can do in a second.
The pod squad have just told us, which you can't hear, but they've said that she thinks Jonathan Pye is a star.
Well, there you go.
Christ, that's what she said.
This is very saccharine for someone tuning in.
Tom,
wanting Jonathan Pye to...
This is your life.
Yes, I was just thinking, this is your life. I expect Eamon to come in with the red book.
How do you keep a healthy relationship with this other person in your life? How old is Jonathan Pye? I mean, not as in how old is the character, but how long has Jonathan Pye been with you?
He will be coming up for 10 years next year. So it's been a long time.
This other character is part of you that's sort of in your life, but of you, but not you.
I mean, everybody thinks I'm him. They think I'm called Jonathan. They think that...
Do you get stopped in the street by people going, Jonathan, I saw
you. I like that distance. I like that they don't know too much about me. There's a little bit of sort of distance between... I find it weird when people say, hey, Tom, I'm like, how on earth do you know my name? I think people think that I believe everything that he says, and that I'm exactly like him. It was really nice to do, which I'm just writing the second series of, but I did a podcast for the BBC called Jonathan Pye, and that's lovely because I can put him with other fictional characters, and therefore I can make it clear when he's wrong, because there's someone in the room to pick him up on it. And that's really liberating, because he can suddenly become a real arsehole. and people don't think it's definitely me.
Now, we've been talking about Keir Starmer's things can only get worse speech.
Yeah, which isn't quite the catchy... It's not going to work. The song they had last time, is it?
Has Jonathan Pye had anything to say about that, or do we have to wait?
It was pretty clear that the Tories were going to lose the last election, and I knew that this was my last sort of opportunity for Pye in his present guise to really stick the boot in. Within 48 hours, I had people on Twitter going, are you going to stick the boot into Labour? And I actually think there are a couple of things there. One, I think it's classier for me to give them 6 months or so before I kind of start starting to weigh in with that. But also, I'm conscious that Pye, his teeth will be dulled slightly, because there was something quite 14 years of this, you know, post-Boris, post-Truss, you know, you have that weight of this constant political turmoil. So I have kind of, it is a period of adjustment, should we say, but I'm not, the few days...
I'm hoping that Trump wins the election.
Well, you say that. It's
comic.
It's after, about 2 days after the election, I was at an event and everyone was asking me, what are you going to do now? As if my career was over. I said to them, I'd much rather the result we had than worry about my career later. But I also think it might make me work a bit harder, particularly Trump, particularly something like Truss. It's what I would call the low-hanging fruit. They're just too easy. Because
he
also,
can live forever, can he? I mean, I look at the pub landlord.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I just assume was a kind of two-year gig, three-year. It goes on. And Al Murray, very, very funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm rinsing it for all it's worth, really. Yeah. I think...
Put that on the posters for the...
Rinsing it.
Rinsing for all it's worth. Yeah.
I think he's probably got another tour in him. And one thing I've never done is I've never attempted to write him for television. With the podcast that I did for radio, it was really nice, almost as an experiment. Does he work in this sort of semi-sitcom world? And I think I've proved that can work. I would hate for in 10 years' time, if it's all over, for someone to turn around and go, why did that never get on the telly? And the answer to be, because I never bothered trying. You know, a TV series or a sitcom for him, you go, that's his legacy, perhaps. You know. Well, but I certainly feel that, not winding him down, but I'm certainly looking at where it will end.
But before it ends,
yes.
Call Jonathan Pye is what you're going to look for on BBC Sounds.
Yes.
That's where you get the series. Call Jonathan Pye. My moment of the week, very, very traditional. I had a British seaside summer holiday this year on the Suffolk coast. And the joy of the end of my holiday each year, bank holiday weekend, is an old-fashioned flower show. But we're talking a proper flower show. Cakes, tarts made, homemade artwork, bit of knitting.
Lovely.
Lovely vegetable, all that. My wife won the best chocolate cake. My daughter won the best decorated cake. Happiness.
Wow.
Nick's pitching for Gardener's World. Clearly. What he doesn't know is that Monty Don has said that he's going to carry on for several years, Nick. So you're not.
Oh, really?
It's not going to happen for you.
No.
I'm telling you, man, it's not going to happen for you. My moment of the week was this morning when I've been following on. You can tell I'm spending a lot of time on Instagram. Have I mentioned I'm on Instagram? And Spencer Matthews, former Made in Chelsea. Playboy is how the Daily Mail described him. I don't think that quite captures him. Anyway, Spencer Matthews, this striking-looking, wonderful mid-30s guy who is now an entrepreneur and podcast and all the rest of it. And he said a while back that he was going to run 30 marathons in 30 days. And I thought this was completely bonkers. And then I looked up the fact that lots of people seem to do this all the time, amazingly. But he was going to do it on sand, which no one has ever done before. And Spencer Matthews, if you look online, has just done this extraordinary feat of human endurance where he has run 30 marathons in 30 days. Anyway, this morning I see this in the papers and I was thinking we've got to get hold of someone to talk about marathon running. And I'm saying to Ollie Stone Lee, who's the utterly, utterly brilliant deputy editor of the Today programme, who's outputting this morning. Should we try Jamie Lang, who's Spencer's mate from Made in Chelsea? And we're trying all these various people. Ollie, as so often happens on the Today programme, presses the talk back button and just says to me, we've got Spencer. I thought, we've got Spencer Matthews, literally after he's just done them.
And he's in a car
from somewhere between the Red Sea and Oman. And we get to speak to Spencer, and it was absolutely wonderful. And do you know the one, I mean, obviously it was intrinsically just really, really nice because he's a remarkable, inspirational bloke. He's just done something absolutely amazing. But do you know what it just proved to me is that when people get asked by the Today programme if they'll come on, they generally say yes.
And say yes.
Which is just a most amazing privilege.
Yeah, you sounded very excited. I was at home thinking, my God, he sounded excited.
Yeah, I was a bit, I overdid it. But then he called me, I overdid it. He called me mate a few times. I thought, sod it, I'm going to call him mate, which is probably dreadfully unprofessional. But anyway, that moment when Ollie said, we've got him, I just thought, God, what a fantastic job.
Lovely. Anyway,
that's my moment of the week.
There we are. Now, if you don't want to have to search each week for a new episode of the Today podcast, or even more than once a week when we do bonus editions, why not make it easy for yourself? Subscribe to the Today podcast on BBC Sounds, and that way you'll get an alert every time we're in the studio together.
And when your friends ask if you've been listening to any good podcasts recently, please do feel free to mention this one.
Mrs. Walker.
How was that, Pippa?
As was.
Thank you very much. Are you happy with his performance, Pippa?
Thumb up, thumb down.
Stunned, absolutely stunned. Has Pippa, who's currently a silent voice talking to us, has Pippa got an Australian accent?
No. Very, very, very English.
Give it another 7 years.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Cheers, Tom.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
BBC Radio 4, 11 Minutes Dead, a paranormal thriller about near-death experience.
We once believed death occurred at the exact moment the heart stopped beating.
Sammy, where are you going?
We now know this is not true.
You don't deserve a daughter, so I will come and take her away.
Listen to 11 Minutes Dead, available now on BBC Sounds.